Okay, here we go. Chapter 17. We're going to move a little bit quicker than what I wanted to, but that's all right, because I'd rather you be comfortable on your papers. All right, he gets smuggled out of Thessalonica. Chapter 17, verse 10. As soon as it was night, the brothers sent Paul and Silas away to Berea. The reason why they sent them out at night is because the officials struck a deal basically with Jason that said, we will let you out as long as you rectify the situation, probably turning over Paul and Silas. And instead what they do is they smuggle them out of the city and send them to Berea. Why'd they send them to Berea? Because it's off the beaten track. It's not on the Via Ignatia. It's actually a pretty insignificant town. And what you'd think is if you're a fugitive running away, this would be a great town for you to go and to just lay low for a little while. And that is not what Paul does at all. But notice who is sent away and who is not going with them to Berea. First of all, where was Luke left? Last time we saw Luke, he was in what city?
Philippi.
Now someone else is being left inside of the city of Thessalonica. Who is it? Timothy. Now Timothy won't stay in Thessalonica for too long, but Timothy does stay behind. Now it's just Paul and Silas going on to Berea. On arriving there, they went to the Jewish synagogue, naturally. Now the Bereans were of more noble character than the Thessalonians. Whoops. For they received the message with great eagerness and examined the scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true. They were engaging with it. They were not just taking his word at what he was saying initially, and they weren't also just rejecting it at what he was saying initially. What they were doing was, okay, explain this to me again. Flip to me, and he says, flip with me to Isaiah 53. You see? And they're like, huh. Yeah, that is a weird passage. I don't really know what to do with that. What about Zechariah 9? Yeah, that's a weird passage too. What do I do with that? How about Psalm 23? Ooh, yeah, that's really... Well, Psalm 22 is even crazier. And all of a sudden, as he's going from passage to passage of the Old Testament, the Bereans are going, huh, that's making somewhat sense. More noble character, because they were actually giving him a hearing. Many of the Jews believed, as did also a number of prominent Greek women, once again, and many Greek men. Luke loves to remind us that women have value. When the Jews in Thessalonica learned that Paul was preaching the word of God at Berea, they went there too. So Paul and Silas have an opportunity to go take a little sabbatical, take some time off and to lay low in this little podunk city of Berea. Instead, what do? Start converting people like crazy to the point where the Jews in Thessalonica hear about it and they go to the podunk city to try to run them out. They went there too, agitating the crowds and stirring them up. Same tactic. Let's get the crowds all riled up, get Rome paying attention, and once Rome pays attention, we'll feed them to the dogs. Verse 14, the brothers immediately sent Paul to the coast, but Silas and Timothy stayed at Berea. So whenever Timothy hears that there's stuff going on in Berea, that the Jews are going there, Timothy leaves from Thessalonica, goes to Berea in order to kind of help out. And what eventually happens is Silas and Timothy stay in Berea while they send Paul to the coast. Why send him to the coast? Say it again.
Thessalonica.
Uh-huh.
And they were going to come back and cause trouble.
Possibly, but why the coast?
It's important
to get ships to go down. Ah. See, because whenever you're walking on foot, you can move 30 to 35 miles a day if you're cruising. But on a boat, you can go over 100 miles a day. And basically what they're saying is you need to get out of here, and you need to get out of here quick. So they send Paul by himself, well, possibly with some Macedonian companions, but not with Paul, not with Silas, Timothy, or Luke, to Athens. Get to the coast, get out of here as quick as you can. The brothers immediately sent Paul to the coast, but Silas and Timothy stayed at Berea. The men who escorted Paul brought him to Athens and then left with instructions for Silas and Timothy to join him as soon as possible. So Paul gets on a ship, goes to Athens with the Macedonian companions, and then he sends them back with the message to get Silas and Timothy there as quick as they could, because he's going to need their help. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, see, Paul... I love Paul because his impatience is not totally a bad thing. Because he just can't help himself. He's sitting there, he's waiting. He's like, I probably should lay low and wait till they get here so that we can, as a team, go and do ministry. But he just can't help himself. He just got to preach. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see the city was full of idols. As a matter of fact, about this time, Athens is a very significant city. Even at this time, even after Rome is taken over, Athens is still significant, not necessarily politically, but for what has come out of Athens throughout its history. Athens is the intellectual capital of the world. Even though Rome took over and basically tried to eradicate a lot of the Greek influence of their political regime, there are some things they could never get rid of from Greek because the Greeks just did it better. Like Plato and Aristotle, the thinkers, Socrates. These people all come from Athens. Intellectual capital of the world. It is also the arts and culture capital of the world. From Athens, we have the very first theater ever in existence that we have evidence of. From Athens, we know that the very first Olympic Games were ever played in Athens. Arts and culture is something that emanated out of this place. And not only was it the intellectual capital of the world, the arts and culture capital of the world, but it was also the religious capital of the world. For in Athens, you have the pantheon of the gods. Up on the hill, overlooking Mars Hill and overlooking the marketplace that they would have spoken from their intellectual thoughts, is the pantheon of the gods, the temple of the gods. So Athens was no place to bat its eye at, even though at this point it had fallen from its primary area of influence. At this point, we're probably thinking that the population would have been anywhere from 20 to 25, maybe 30,000 people. Very low. As a matter of fact, one Roman author made fun of Athens, and he said it's easier to find an idol than it is to find a man in the city of Athens. Because in the city itself, archaeologically, we can count about a little bit over than 2,000 idols in this one city. 2,000 idols. So Paul's there by himself, and he's just getting overwhelmed. So many idols, it's hard to stomach. Yes? Do we know what year this is? Let's see, 44 is the last indicator that we had in chapter 12. Then we had the first council, and maybe 40. This probably would have been around 49-ish. It'd be by about, I think it would be about the, yeah, I think that's about right, about around 49. Because this is where he's going to be moving into Corinth. Some of his key letters will be being written around this time period. He's going to start writing. Yeah, this could have been anywhere from 50 to 51, actually. That's probably what I would say. And the reason why is because we know that I think 1 Thessalonians was probably the first letter written in the New Testament. And I think it came shortly after his time in Thessalonica because of the urgency that the letter was sent. As a matter of fact, he even talks about 1 Thessalonians, I think it's 1 where he, or 2. Timothy has just now come back to us and he's told us about your great faith and your great love to the Thessalonians, but he doesn't talk to them about their hope because their hope is what's lacking. So probably around 50-51 is where we're at. Yeah?
When you say 2,000 idols, do you mean like 2,000 different gods or just like 2,000 individuals?
2,000 idols. Sometimes there'd be more idol to one god, but that probably represents about that number of gods. So it doesn't necessarily mean individual gods, every one of them. It could be, because there'll be multiple statues to Zeus. But at the same time, that's roughly the amount of gods they would have had in their pantheon. Yes?
What did you estimate the population of Athens was?
At this time, when he's there, it could have been, it probably was around 20 to 30,000. So it had significantly decreased. You're talking the size of the population of Joplin, a little bit less. Inside of Athens at this time, even though at one point it was probably, you know, a couple hundred thousand. So much different. It's not in its heyday anymore. Nevertheless, it's still widely respected.
Is that because of the Roman rule?
Yeah. If you were the Romans, you would love the fact that Athens was kind of in ill repair, had fallen kind of out of prominence at this point, because it kind of made it was kind of a commentary in a sense of Rome's dominance over the Greek Empire. Absolutely. So you probably discouraged people going to Athens, especially because it meant so much to the Greeks. Okay, we need to keep moving. So he reasoned in the synagogue, naturally, with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as, notice it adds something to the formula, in the marketplace, day by day, with those who happened to be there. Why? Because in Athens, that's what you did. Don't get me wrong, Jewish synagogue is the place to launch from. But in Athens, the intellectual capital of the world, one of the places where they would, the key bantering places of ideas would be in the marketplace. And eventually it would lead to kind of the university setting. And eventually, it could even make it all the way up to Mars Hill. A major rock right down below the Pantheon itself that overlooked the marketplace. And this rock would have had the Areopagus / Mars Hill. That actually has two names. I probably should define both of them. Mars Hill is the actual rock, and it is a rock. I've stood on it before. It's a really big, bumpy rock. Mars Hill is the rock itself, but they would also call the same location the Areopagus. But technically, the Areopagus is the name of the council of 30 men that would meet on the rock called Mars Hill. Nevertheless, the location used both names, so if you hear Areopagus or you hear Mars Hill, it's referring to the same location. The council of the 30 men that would come and sit on a rock, and they would deliberate the key thoughts that were coming out of the marketplaces and the universities. And eventually that's where Paul ends up. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Let's talk about them really quick. These would have been the top two philosophy groups inside of the city of Athens. Epicureans is the first one. These are those that follow the teachings of Epicurus, which is naturally their name, Epicureans, Epicurus. He was around the 4th to 3rd century B.C., 341 to 270 B.C., if you really want to know. And here are some of the key beliefs of the Epicureans. Now, this may be good test questions, by the way. Key beliefs of the Epicureans. Number one, they believed that the highest goal of living was pleasure of the body and of the soul. Highest goal was to accumulate the most pleasure that you could for the body and the soul. Number two, they believed that matter is eternal. That there was never a time when the world was not. They believed it was eternal. Matter is eternal. Number three, and yet, they do not believe that there is immortality of the soul. They believe that when you die, it's over. So, the Epicureans' key beliefs are, number one, pleasure of the body and of the soul are the highest goals of living. Number two, matter is eternal. There never was a time when the world was not. And number three, there is no immortality of the soul. When you die, it's done. I do want to make a key distinction, though, because sometimes people take the very first one, pleasure of the body, and they say, so they can do whatever they want. No, Epicurus would never say that this is, you could just go into unadulterated hedonism. What he would say is that you want to advocate pleasure in any way, shape, or form, unless whatever it is you're advocating, if it leads to pain for you in any way, or to pain for other people, you avoid it. Because pain is to be, that's the whole goal of Epicureanism, is to exalt pleasure and avoid pain at all costs. So if there's something that is pleasurable that could lead to pain, you would still avoid it as an Epicurean. Nevertheless, the goal was still pleasure at all costs. That's the Epicureans. The Stoics, the second group, followed the philosophy, the teachings of Zeno of Cyprus, who was around the 4th century to 3rd century B.C. as well, 335 to 263. And the reason why they're called Stoics is because a lot of his teachings was done in the marketplace that was called the Stoa. That was where most of his teachings was done, and they eventually adopted the name Stoics as their movement. Their key beliefs. Number one, self-denial is the highest goal. It leads to the highest goal, self-denial. This means they would try to suppress all passions. All passions they would suppress. Pleasure or things that were both pleasurable and things that were both not pleasurable, evil, bad, you wouldn't even react to them. You would suppress your reaction to anything that came into your life. Apathy was a high goal of the Stoics. Both their face posture, that's why somebody, if you're just sitting there and you're kind of like this, somebody's like, my goodness, you look Stoic. You know, like you're just dazing off into nothing, because that's their goal, complete apathy. They are not controlled by the stimulants that come into their environment. The denial of self is the highest goal of living. Number two, Zeus created the world, therefore the world is not eternal. Matter is not eternal. Why? Because Zeus created it. There was a time when the world was not. And number three, the soul was immortal. So the Stoics' three key beliefs, self-denial leads to the highest goal of living. Number two, Zeus created the world and therefore the world is not eternal. And number three, the soul was immortal. It would last forever. Now, even though you can see the key differences between these two groups, there are some distinct similarities. Number one, both groups sought to liberate man from fate. They were both trying to break off the chains of fate in some way, shape, or form. The way in which the Epicureans did this was by denying the existence of fate at all. They could reason and logic everything. They didn't need to rely on something outside of themselves. They denied its existence. The Stoics, they wanted to liberate man from fate by refusing to respond to the consequences of fate. They said fate was a real thing, but if we do not respond to it, then we actually are liberated from it. So both of them did not like fate and they wanted to liberate themselves from it. And that's important because of what Paul describes in his speech in just a minute. Another thing, number two, both of them had a strong emphasis on ethics, but it was from the opposite ends of the spectrum. Strong emphasis on ethics. But the Epicureans are over here saying everything that is pleasurable is to be pursued. And then the people over here that are Stoics, they would say, you do not respond in any way, shape, or form to the stimulants around you. But ethical living was something that would empower both their beliefs. All right, that's the Epicureans and Stoics. Moving on. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with them. Some of them asked, what is this babbler trying to say? Babbler is a specific Greek word that means seed picker. And it's describing in the marketplace, a bird would come at the end of the day and he'd start just gathering any of the seeds he could find. It didn't matter what was there. It didn't matter he wasn't looking for anything in particular. He was just trying to gather whatever seeds he could get and gather them together and take them away. Because he was in desperation just trying to survive. And in a sense, that's what they're calling Paul that intellectually. They say, man, this guy's just syncretistic. He's grabbing whatever he can just to make up his flimsy argument. He's a seed picker. He's just grabbing whatever he can just to survive. What is this babbler, this seed picker, trying to say? Others remarked, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Duh, naturally, that's what he always talks about. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus. Remember, on Mars Hill, the council of 30 men known as the Areopagus. Areopagus, where they said to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean. All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to ideas, the latest ideas. I love that. That little side note. All they did is sat around and just talked about everything that was new. Oh, what did you think about recently? Oh, this is what I heard recently. That's all they ever did. Kind of. Verse 22. Paul then stood up at the meeting of the Areopagus and said, men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. Now that word religious could go one of two ways. It could be positive, which he says, I can see you guys are very devout people. Your devotion is something to be admired. Or it could mean superstitious. I can see that you guys are paranoid. All I need to do is look around at all the stinking gods that you have made from idols. It could go either one. At this point, they don't really know where he's headed. But as he keeps going, they understand it's probably the second one he's targeting. Their paranoia, because they're trying to make sure they have a god for every single one they interact with. Because if they leave out one god, that means that one god could punish them for being shamed. So he says, I see that you guys are very religious. What does that mean? Verse 23. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with the inscription, to an unknown god. Now what you worship is something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you. Why have a statue to an unknown god? Number one, pragmatic. In case you left out a god, this one's kind of a catch-all. Oh man, I don't want to tick off any god just because I left him out. So the unknown god, we'll just throw that one in there. That way, if the god says, hey, why didn't you worship me? And say, hey, that's what this altar was for. because I didn't know who you were. Number two, there is a guy that lived in the city by the name of Socrates. Very fascinating fellow. Socrates actually was forced to drink poison because of his belief that there was only one true God, and he rejected all the other gods of the pantheons. As a matter of fact, the exact accusation that they make of Paul whenever they say, where is it at? Babbler. He seems to be advocating foreign gods. That's the same accusation they leveled against Socrates. Socrates says, my logic and my reason has revealed to me that there is only one God. I just don't know his name. And what's fascinating to me is we also know that Socrates was a stonemason. So it is very possible that this altar that he's referring to, the altar of an unknown God, may have been carved out of the very hands of Socrates. But they gave Socrates a decision, an ultimatum at one point. He was imprisoned for his belief in one God. And they said, you either recant or drink the hemlock, drink the poison. And Socrates says, give me the poison, because I believe in one true God. I just don't know his name. And Paul says, but what you don't know, what Socrates doesn't know, I want to tell you. In America, there are certain things that if you get accused of, it's really bad in our culture. Like if somebody accuses you of being lazy, in our culture, that's a big deal. You have to fight for everything that you earn. Or if somebody says you're inefficient or unproductive, in our culture, those are bad words. In Athenian culture, if somebody says you don't know something, that's like the worst thing you could say to them. The worst thing you could say to them is, well, you're just not very enlightened. And what does Paul say? Now, what you worship is something unknown, what you're ignorant of, I will now proclaim to you. Let me be your teacher, O Areopagus. Those are what we call fighting words that you use in the playground and eventually get hurt from. But we'll talk about more of that tomorrow. Love you guys. See you then.